Welcome to Energy Law Roundup, your comprehensive weekly briefing on legal news and developments in the energy industry from Texas and across the country, always in 30 minutes or less. And now, your host for Energy Law Roundup, business litigator and oil and gas trial lawyer, Tom Charlone.
It is the week of August 7th, 2017. Again, my name is Tom Charlone. I'm a litigation partner at Kane Russell, Coleman & Logan, resident in our firm's Houston, Texas office. In a significant development out of the United States Department of the Interior, the Office of Natural Resources Revenue has decided to eliminate the prior administration's new guidance for calculating royalties on leases of oil and gas interests on federal and Native American lands. As detailed in a recent notice from the Federal Register, Interior is completely repealing what had been dubbed by President Obama as the Consolidated Federal Oil and Gas and Federal and Indian Coal Valuation Reform Rule. The rule had become effective at January 1st of this year, and it operated to revise long-standing valuation rules by computing royalties as a function of arm's-length transactions in the marketplace. In a statement, the Department of the Interior blasted the rule, arguing that it would, quote, unnecessarily burden the development of federal oil and gas and federal and Indian coal beyond the degree necessary to protect the public interest. This, of course, would be an obvious tension with the Trump administration's mandate to all federal agencies to put the kibosh on regulations that stand in the way of developing the full potential of our domestic energy resources. The Interior Department went on to say that it, quote, expects that further internal assessment and analysis will lead to the development and promulgation of a new revised valuation rule that will address the various problems that have now been identified in the rule we are repealing. The nixing of the Obama valuation rule will become operative this September. Critics of the rollback of the rule maintain that the reinstatement of the old rule is to take a trip back in time, since that rule was promulgated in the 1980s. And this means that the aging regulation is out of sync with the many drastic changes in energy technology and markets that have taken place in the decades since. In a big victory for the industry, the Federal Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals recently affirmed the dismissal of a proposed class action filed by a laid-off former employee of Latshaw Drilling Company, based on the theory that the driller had run afoul of the Worker Adjustment and Retraining Notification Act, the so-called WARN Act. In particular, the Fifth Circuit determined that the aspirant class action failed to satisfy the WARN Act's threshold requirement of a single site. On this score, the statute puts the onus on employers to provide timely written notice to state employment regulators and to all impacted workers if the employer intends to lay off in excess of 50 workers at a single site. It was this single-site requirement that was fatal to the plaintiff's claims in this case. The defendant's business model was such that it dispatches drilling crews to various customer sites. The wrinkle here is that the company's drilling crews were never comprised of any more than 28 workers. Latshaw, not unreasonably, therefore took the position that, taken in isolation, there was not so much as one work site with more than 50 employees, and accordingly, the WARN Act doesn't even apply. The plaintiff maintained that under the circumstances, it would be appropriate and more equitable to marry the various sites into a single location for purposes of analysis under the statute. The Fifth Circuit, however, was having none of that. Justice Priscilla Owen, writing the opinion for the undivided appellate panel, observed that the plaintiff, quote, has not pointed to any grouping of job sites in which, between the sites, Latshaw laid off 50 or more employees within the relevant WARN Act period. His attempt to create a single site of employment by grouping drilling rigs managed by a single drilling superintendent does not cure this evidentiary deficiency, nor does his conclusion that common management has been held sufficient to bind as many as 8 discrete sites together as one single site of employment. Notably, the Fifth Circuit sided with the employer even though overall nearly 400 workers were let go by the drilling company in the wake of the recent slump in oil prices. The case is Meadows v. Latshaw Drilling Company, number 16-10988, pending in the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. The Seventh Court of Appeals in Amarillo has rejected a jury verdict in favor of Hunt Cimarron in a long-running controversy over a West Texas mineral lease. The Texas Intermediate Appellate Court reasoned that the lease in question had come to an end by operation of its own terms because the operator was simply not producing. Hunt Cimarron had taken the position that the full leasehold had been perpetuated beyond the expiration of its primary term in 2011 by way of the mineral lease's reworking provisions. Under such clauses, operators can sometimes preserve the lease past its initial term if they commence operations that constitute, in the words of the Seventh Court, a good faith effort to cause a well or wells to produce oil or gas in paying quantities. In this case, the lease provided that the party's agreement continues only as to land included within a defined oil and gas production unit, including wells being reworked. Hunt therefore took the position that it held the entire lease by reworking these wells. The appellate court disagreed and held that the savings clause covers only limited acreage surrounding each producing well. In particular, here's what the Seventh Court had to say, quote, because the mineral lessor met its burden of showing the occurrence of the determinable condition, in other words, the absence of production as to all other acreage, and the operator failed to meet its burden of establishing the application of a savings provision obviating the application of the termination provision, as to those acres, the subject lease expired as a matter of law at the end of the primary term as to those non-productive acres. The opinion is also notable for a further reason that operators should stop and take notice of. Aside from their main claims of lease termination, the mineral lessors also contended that Hunt had failed to execute a release setting forth the acreage and depths that were no longer held by the lease. The Seventh Court of Appeals agreed with the mineral owners on this point. Remember, most mineral leases require that a release be filed of record within a specified period of time following the lessee's loss of acreage under a lease. While some operators casually treat this as a housekeeping matter, this lackadaisical attitude could potentially have much more serious consequences if this obligation is not approached soberly. Mineral lessors could take the position that an operator's failure to timely release acreage deprives them of the ability to enter into new, lucrative lease arrangements with other oil and gas companies. To avoid this kind of exposure, operators would be wise to give their full attention to lease provisions that require them to put acreage releases in place by a specific deadline. As always, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. The case is Hardin-Simmons University v. Hunt Cimarron, number 07-15-00303, pending in the Seventh Court of Appeals in Amarillo, Texas. In another nod to President Trump's agenda to topple barriers to domestic oil and gas production, the Bureau of Land Management has announced that it intends to pull back a rule put in place by the Obama administration that heavily regulates fracking on federal and tribal lands. The rule in question gave rise to a whole host of rigorous new rules, including a variety of regulations aimed at well casing and wastewater storage, not to mention controversial disclosure requirements that would mandate that fracking operators publicly disclose the chemicals they use in their downhole operations. Here's what the agency had to say in a statement, quote, the BLM believes that the 2015 final rule unnecessarily burdens industry with compliance costs and information requirements that are duplicative of regulatory programs of many states and some tribes. The Department of the Interior also weighed in publicly on the BLM's plan to eliminate the Obama-era rule. Council. Vincent DeVito, the department's counselor for energy policy, released a statement in which he noted that, quote, "The Department of the Interior's approach toward overseeing wells is to be better business partners and environmental stewards, which is in alignment with the Trump administration's across-the-board prioritization of domestic energy production. This means flexibility to regulate fracking and a rulemaking process open to all members of the public." Finally, we've got a notable decision issuing from the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, and this one has the potential to have some really wide-reaching effects on the oil and gas business domestically here in the United States. The case revolves around the 2008 Chapter 11 bankruptcy of a midstream company, SEM Group LP, and its affiliates. A number of producers sold oil to SEM Group, which then resold the oil to a number of third parties, including BP Oil Supply Company and J. Aaron & Company. At the time it went belly up, SEM Group had yet to pay the producers for the oil, which by that point had already been purchased by BP and J. Aaron. The oil producers tried to take the position that they had a security interest that ran with the oil as it traveled downstream through SEM Group to BP, J. Aaron, and other third-party purchasers. The Third Circuit was highly unimpressed with this argument. Here's what the three-judge panel had to say, and the justices certainly did not mince their words. Quote, "The producer's contention that a lien or trust follows oil from their wells to the gas pump does not make sense for this type of market. The effect of any opinion from us upholding the producer's opinion would be chaos." Putting the final nail in the producer's coffin, the Third Circuit pulled no punches when it wrote that, quote, "All told, the producers misunderstand the burdens and uncertainty their arguments would create." The operators from Texas had hung their hats on UCC provisions from that jurisdiction that automatically gives rise to a perfected security interest in oil, and the operators based in Oklahoma, for their part, opined that they were protected by state law theories of an implied trust. The Third Circuit, however, reminded the producers that SEM Group is a Delaware entity, and to perfect a lien there, that requires one to file a financing statement. At the end of the day, according to the Third Circuit, quote, "The producers simply took no action to protect themselves, at least not according to the procedures required in the governing jurisdiction." The case is In Re SEM Crude LP, case number 15-3094, pending in the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit.
Thank you for listening to Energy Law Roundup. If you would like additional information about anything from today's episode, you can contact Tom at 210-446-6999 or by email at tom@charlone.net. New episodes of this podcast are available every week on the web at www.energylawroundup.com, your one-stop source for breaking news and developments in energy law.